Just want to welcome everybody here this morning. Thank you very much for joining us. Looks to be a wonderful and hopefully thought-provoking day. Just on behalf, I want to make a couple thank yous. First and foremost, I want to thank the Shaar HaShemaim congregation and Rabbi Straffler, who's not here, who was instrumental in organizing today's sessions, and really appreciate his efforts, and Shaar HaShemaim for being the wonderful host that they always are to Yeshiva University. We greatly appreciate it. Secondly, I'd like to express thanks to the Legacy Heritage Foundation and to the, within Yeshiva University, as well as the Center for the Jewish Future, which have provided the resources and the funding for this program for us here in Toronto. We are deeply grateful for that. Allow me to not waste any more of your time hearing Dr. Blumenthal, or not waste any more time hearing me.
Thank you.
And better yet, and hearing Dr. Blumenthal.
Can you speak to my mother?
So allow me just to do the courtesy of an introduction. So Dr. Blumenthal, he's the education director of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kollel Elyon, which is the honors smicha program at Yeshiva University, which provides training and counseling, public speaking, and the like to prospective rabbis. Dr. Blumenthal is also a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice in Cedarhurst, New York. He, having received his master's in 1976 and a doctorate in 1981 from Adelphi University, he is the founder and chairman of CAHAL. And in addition, Dr. Blumenthal serves as the coordinator of group psychotherapy training for interns and residents at the North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System and consultant for TOVA, a mentoring program for disenfranchised teens. Dr. Blumenthal is a past vice president and current board member of NEFESH, the International Network of Mental Health Professionals. And Dr. Blumenthal also runs a parent program for parental loss and grief for High Lifeline, and recently assumed the position of director of bereavement and crisis intervention services. So without any further ado, allow me to welcome Dr. Blumenthal.
Thank you very much. I think I much more. You're leaving, so I just want to thank you for everything you're doing.
I'll be back.
Okay, good. All right. So now you heard everything about me. About 50% of that is true. So this is what I'm going to just share with you, actually, something very funny I once heard at a bris, which will serve maybe as a segue into our subject. I was once at a bris for the first grandchild of this gentleman who was speaking, and he asked the question. He said, at a bris, we say, Kishem Shanifmas, a bris. Just like the child came into the bris, he should come to the Torah and to the chuppah. So he said, the kid's 8 days old. What are we bothering him? What are you talking about chaining with the Torah and the chuppah and all that? He said, now he is a grandfather. He understands. Shame, shenif, that's the bris. Just like the grandfather paid for the bris, he's going to pay for the bar mitzvah. And he understands. And that's basically what we're talking about today. We're going to be talking about the sandwich generation, the generation that's taking care of older children, children. Even as you'll see from some of the, you might even see ahead of time from some of the slides, but everybody have one of these? Did everybody? Yeah, okay, I'm gonna put them out over here just in case people come late. I'll put it over here. And so the so-called boomerang kids, which is the kids that are coming back home after being away and attending and caring to older adults and to older parents, which is a new phenomenon as you'll see shortly. So what we're gonna do is I'm gonna go with some statistics. And then I'm going to talk about some of the psychological issues, and then pragmatically, we'll end with some approaches, what seems to be the best way to handle some of these kind of situations. Okay, so just for a starter. In the early 1900s, the average life expectancy was 40.9. Today it's 78. So within the span of 100 years, life expectancy has doubled. And that's important to a certain end, we'll get to later, because this is a pretty new phenomenon, that we have parents or people or adults living to very old ages and living, you know, cognizant and with it, et cetera, but still needing sometimes services and help. Okay, by 2030, the number of Americans 65 or older will double to 71 million, or 20% of the population. This is the United States statistics. I don't have Canada, but let's assume they're comparable. I'd probably even longer here because everybody's frozen. So, okay, there are approximately 80,000 centenarians in America today. It's estimated there'll be a million 100 years old, 100 million 100 year olds by 2050. So being 100 is not a novelty anymore.
You will be too.
Okay. This is an important point, by the way, in terms
of five members in the synagogue that are over.
There you go. Okay. They have they paid the dues? The number of geriatricians in this country is dwindling, not growing. In other words, geriatricians, which are the comparable physicians for pediatricians, the elderly, are going down instead of going up in numbers. Now, I'm not a physician, but I'm in psychology. As mentioned, I have an affiliation with North Shore Long Island Jewish, which is a major hospital in the New York metropolitan area. And the psychiatric facility has a geriatric, a general psychiatry program. I think it's one of three in the whole country. And I supervise residents, and even though I'm not involved with medication personally, because I'm a psychologist, but many of them say that medicating the elderly is very different than medicating adults because of all the complications and medical involvements. In fact, when they sometimes have to cover, you know, they'll cover for one another, unless they have training in general psych, they're very loath to cover for someone attending to the needs of the elderly. And yet, the number of geriatricians in the country are dwindling. The American Geriatric Society reports that we have 14,000 geriatricians short today. By 2030, we'll need 15,000 more. It's known in the field of medicine as the 2030 problem, that we're going to be about 30,000 geriatricians short in about 20 years from now. Only five of the United States' 145 medical schools have a Department of Geriatric Medicine, and only 3% of medical students take courses in this area. So the population is getting older, the medical needs are getting greater, and the people who are equipped and trained to attend to the needs of the elderly population are dwindling. And this, of course, will fall on the shoulders of the sandwich generation. Geriatricians are among the lowest paid physicians largely depend on Medicare. I'm not sure if that applies here with socialized medicine, but in the States, you'll get reimbursed better if you remove a wart than to talk about how someone's doing after their husband's passed away. So that's generally the trend that physicians get reimbursed more generously for procedures than attending to the more general needs of their patients. Okay, just a break with a cartoon. It shows a man dying and it says he's still in therapy as he's a therapist. Okay, so this therapist will. In 2000, this is the boomerang kids. Of course, they're playing the words of the baby boomers, which are the kids that come back home. In 2006, 46.7% of women and 53.7% of men between ages 18 and 24 lived in their parents' house. This is in 2006, that's why the past tense. So there's a lot of kids in the ages of 18 to 24, basically adults, and this is going to pose the problem that we're going to talk about. So besides having to attend to the elderly, many people now are having children who are basically adults living at home, an increasing number. 14.3% of men between ages of 25 and 34 lived at home, compared to 10.6% in the 60s. And those of you in 1960, those of you know, in the 60s, the thing was to move out and become independent. And yet we have more people living at home than we did before that whole era began. 73% of graduating seniors carry loan debt of an average of $23,000. Undergraduate debt in 2004 was $2,169. So one of the reasons, and a part of the problem, is that the kids are coming out of college with huge debt that they have to pay back and therefore cannot necessarily afford to live independently. 58% of college graduates report moving back home, and 32% stay for over a year. So more than half college graduates come back home. And this is important, we're going to get to it later, because it's a very different experience living at home consistently and moving away from the home and moving back. Okay. Right, but everybody see I'm wearing a jacket? Okay, good. I just want to make sure it's known. All right. 75% of those who moved back did so immediately after graduating. 48% moved back to save money, so obviously money is a major consideration. 37% moved back because they were unemployed. This was before the recession. This is 2006. So we can certainly anticipate that number will grow. This is a survey that was done, the 2006 Life After College Survey, which was a big survey throughout the country of what's happening to our college graduates. 92% did not have to pay for utilities while living at home. 85% did not have to pay rent. 74% did not have to pay for groceries. So we see that they're moving back home, and in that respect, in terms of the financial dependency, are pretty much resuming the life they had prior to college, where they're pretty much being taken care of. Of those college grads who lived at home, 59% report feeling neutral, 31% embarrassed, and 10% proud and happy. So more people, even though most seem rather neutral about it, most are still seem to feel like it's a bit of a stigma at, let's say, the age of 24 to be living at home. Okay, now let's go to the sandwich generation, which is what we're talking about. According to Census Bureau data, more than 3.6 million parents live with adult children, up 67% from the year 2000. So a lot more parents are starting to live with children. By the way, I meant to get statistics on this because I read it somewhere, and I couldn't find it. But We're also finding a reverse snowboard, a snowbird phenomenon. Some of you may know that more and more now, the elderly are starting to move back from Florida because of their medical needs, et cetera, that they have to live with children. So we're having a reverse of what we saw many years ago with people leaving Florida to move back up north to be with children. Excuse me. According to Fidelity, 10% of adults provide frequent financial support for their parents. The AARP report, you know, the AARP is the Association of American Retired Persons, American Association of Retired Persons, report that 44% of 45 to 55-year-olds have at least one living parent and one child under 21. In other words, that they have a living parent, they have a child under 21. Undoubtedly, the numbers are higher for the Orthodox Jewish community because we have larger families, get started earlier, etc. So it's very, very likely that someone in this age range is taking care of children and taking care of the parents. Only 7% of U.S. population have three generations in one house, so it's still not common to have the three generations in one house. This is a very recent report. Christian Companion Senior Care and Presto Service Study reported in the New York Times 8/11/08 that 53% of the sandwich generation feel forced to choose at least once a week between their children and ailing parents. One in five say they have to make such choices every day. So a very significant number of people in this age range, let's say the 45 to 55, saying that just using broad strokes, have to at least, the majority, have to at least once a week make a choice whether they're going to spend time with the children or spend time with their adults. And as I said, they say one in five say they have to make those choices every day. So it's much and more of a reality today where people in this generation, this group, are being pulled in two directions. Okay, take a break, and just showing generation gaps. It shows a mother and a father with a son. He said, it's very important you try very, very hard to remember where you electronically transferred mommy and daddy's assets. I'm happy to love cartoons. Okay. Now, who are the providers? They all have copies of these cartoons, so enjoy them. Okay. Care providers for elderly parents are more likely to be women, 75% versus 25%. Studies in children caring for adults found that daughters want siblings and teamwork, and sons function much more independently, excluding siblings. Age-old gender difference, which is that women want teamwork, women want contact, men want to function independently. In fact, I'll just tell you something interesting. I just mentioned to Rabbi Mostavsky that everyone knows Rabbi Mostavsky from the Center for Jewish Future, one of the key players in this wonderful movement. But that I last Tuesday night I was broadcast by Chabad to all the shluchim to help talk to them, to how to explain to their children what happened in Mumbai, and they emailed in questions from all from Brazil, from Russia. It was a very interesting experience. And some of the questions had to do with my wife's all upset, what do I do? And it was the classic gender difference, which is that men try to solve and women need companionship. So I really had to tell a lot of these guys, like, don't offer her solutions, cry with her, commiserate. That's what the women need, men want solutions. But here we see that again, that the women want teamwork, men want to function independently. This seems to apply as well in terms of caring for adults, at least, probably caring for children as well. Here's something interesting. Professional mediators specializing in helping siblings negotiate is a $2 trillion industry. In other words, it's now become a major industry to help families mediate differences between siblings in terms of caring for adults. So it shows you the extent to which that this has become a problem. Okay, so what are the psychological issues caring for the elderly? So this being a Yeshiva University event and a Shomrei Shemayim event, it pays to bring in something from our rabbis in a recent parsha. It says, and we're going to read in about 2 weeks, Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov settled. And the rabbi said, what does it mean, settled? What pikesh Yaakov, leshe b'shava, kapatel rugzov shel Yosef. Yaakov at this point was an old man, Jacob was an old man, and he wanted to take it easy. He figured, he's paid his dues. He's by this point over 100. And then suddenly, kapatel love, and it leaped upon him, the anguish of Joseph. And this is part of the problem with this being at this age or this place in your life. Your kids are grown up. You've been waiting for years, right? They're going to grow up and they're going to be on their own. You can finally take it easy. You can finally have that financial margin of comfort. You can finally start taking some vacations. What happens? The 24-year-old moves back home and doesn't pay for groceries or anything like that, and you're still taking care of him. And now you're taking care of your elderly parents. And I think that part of the challenge for what I have seen in terms of my work for this sandwich generation is the expectation. you know, when you give birth to children, when you're young and you're giving birth to children, you know what you're in for. You know, it's like you know you're gonna have years and years of tuitions and then headaches and sleepless nights and all that. But you wait for that moment when they finally grow up and they're okay, and you figure now you can take it easy. And just at that point, when you think you can take it, when you finally think you can relax and have that financial margin of comfort, next thing you know, you're taking care of elderly parents, and you saw the kids are still a burden, still, you know, pulling upon you. So there's that thought, that expectation. I almost often felt, this is a medrash, I think it's brought down by Rashi too, that our rabbis are almost critical of Jacob, critical of Yaakov, for that expectation. Because, you know, there is no shalva, there is no peace. There's always responsibilities and demands. Maybe there won't be, but you have to anticipate. It's that expectation. And the first thing I would say to someone who's in this position, whose kids are, you know, now in college, now gone out, now away from the home, before you let your hair down, don't be so sure. There may be other challenges and responsibilities. There's another piece to the psychological issue, which is a huge adjustment, which is your provider and protector becomes needy and less competent. Extremely important point. Our mindset, and it doesn't matter how old they are, our parents take care of us. Our parents are the ones who took us to the doctor and kissed our boo-boos and advised us and directed us, etc. They are supposed to be the ones we're dependent upon. And now, suddenly, they are dependent upon us. And there's a basic truth in psychology, which is that reality always changes faster than the mind. So something can happen in reality, but until you psychologically adjust to it, it takes longer. So it's really a psychological adjustment. Yeah, I say again, taking care of the person who took care of you. And conversely, for the elderly person, being dependent on someone you took care of. So at both ends, there's this huge shift. Because now, your child, who for years and years now, you have provided for, you have taken care of, who has turned to you, now you have to turn to them. And it's not only a change in reality, it's a change in your mindset and how you think. And that's very hard. And I've heard many people describe, I had one patient who described to me when he had to take his father for a haircut. And he was crying in my office, and my father took me for a haircut. You know, it's a very hard adjustment when you have to now suddenly shift gears, shift like that. In fact, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think this might be the most important line in the whole presentation, is the paradigm shift when you have elderly parents and older children, because you're shifting at both ends. The people who are supposed to take care of you, now you're taking care of them. That's your elderly parents. The kids, now these adult child who lives in your home, whom you're supposed to be taking care of all your life, now you have to withdraw your care because they're adults. They're self-sufficient. So you're going like this. You're changing in both ways. You're changing in terms of your mindset regarding the parents, who now you have to take care of, and you have to change your mindset, as we'll get to later, regarding the kid, because you can't send him to his room because you don't like how he's behaving when he's 25 years old. It doesn't work that way. You know, there's the old joke about the two Jewish mothers sitting on a park bench in Miami, and one's talking about her 52-year-old son who still lives at home and takes such good care of her. He says, but he's seeing some doctor, and the doctor says he has something called an Oedipus. The other one says, Oedipus, Schmidipus, as long as he loves his mother. But this is the key point. It's not only a change in reality, it's a change in your way of thinking. Because now, as I said, the people who took care of you, you're taking care of them. The people who you, for 20-some years, you've taken care of, now you have to withdraw your care. Now you have to withdraw your parenting. So you have to start becoming a parent to someone you've never parented before, and withdraw your parenting from someone you've parented for years and years. Okay, so there's a change in your identity. And that's a very important point, and that's psychologically how we adjust to new situations. We redefine ourselves. We are no longer the child who can depend on the older person. We are now the primary provider. We are the parent to our parents. And not only that, but to our children, whom we have identified ourselves as the providers, we now have to withdraw and change that definition. We're no longer a parent to them. We are a parent to them, but a different kind of parent. So we have to change your identity or place in the generational hierarchy, because now you are the primary provider to your parents, and you may not be the primary provider or less of a primary provider to your child. So there's a shift in reality, but there's a shift in terms of how you define yourself. And if you can make that shift, part of the problem, we'll get to that a little bit later, part of the problem is people who stick to the past, who try to hold on to whom they were, or the situation as it was, and then are thrown off by the new realities. But if you adjust your thinking and how you define yourself, then the new realities will be much more manageable. Okay, now here's another very interesting point. It's actually a point that's brought in a famous book called a sefer called the Chovos HaLevavos. Missing is the instinctive attraction and magnetism. What do I mean? Well, you have a little six-month-old who gives you a toothless smile with a full diaper, you find it irresistible, right? You want to hug them and hold them. But you can have another human being who gives you a toothless smile with a full diaper, but he's 98, and as we say in French, it's not so geschmack, you know? It just doesn't appeal to you, it doesn't draw you. Why? They're both needy people with toothless smiles and full diapers. Why is it different? So the Chovos HaLevavos actually brings something very interesting, which is that he says that God made us, and I think this is a psychological truism, that we're attracted to babies. We have this natural, I don't have to tell you, anybody comes in, they have a baby, oh, he's so cute, and everybody wants to hold him or her, etc. What is it? It's this dribbling, this thing, spitting up, pulling up their diaper, you know, what's so appealing? We have a built-in attraction to babies, and if you want to look at it scientifically, you could say evolutionary, from an evolutionary perspective, it developed, because if there wasn't an attraction, we would throw them out. I mean, who'd want them? Unfortunately, we hear in other communities, sometimes people do. But we have this natural, instinctive attraction to babies. We don't have it to the elderly. It's much harder. And first of all, the idea, as I said earlier, that as you saw from the statistics, this concept, this idea that people are growing so old is brand new. It's just happening in our times. So even built in, there isn't this attraction to them, but also we weren't wired that way. We're not made that way. And as I said, the Chovos HaLevavos brings this down, that we're wired to be attracted to babies. We're not wired to be attracted. So caring, having to clean and attend to an elderly person takes a lot of getting used to, and there's much more of an aversion than there would be to be. I'm sorry to say it, but it's a reality. We have to face it. Another thing that's interesting is that the renewed involvement reawakens old issues. Okay, nobody has a perfect relationship with a parent. There's always, that's how I make a living. I mean, thank God for that. You know, I wouldn't pay my tuitions if everybody got along with their parents, you know? So everybody has issues with, even when you had a good relationship, there's always pieces of it that are always things that are a little annoying and off-putting or whatever. When you've moved out of your house and you got married and you visit with your own kids, so you see your parents from time to time, they might come over for a holiday or something, but it's not as intense because you're not involved with them day in and day out. So those are little annoying things you can really almost forget about because you're not really with them. Now, if the parent moves back in, or if the parent moves now to a healthcare facility near you, and every single day you're with that parent, some of those old issues can start coming back. Some of those old annoyances will either from remembering them or because the parent's behavior suddenly having to deal with it every day comes up. So you find yourself almost in a way back in a situation that you thought you had long ago left when you moved out of your house, and that sometimes takes some getting used to. Another very interesting phenomenon, which I think we have to think about, is that many of the elderly did not witness the aging of their parents because of shorter life expectancies, war, Holocaust. There's no template for effective and dignified aging. This is a brand new phenomenon. And our parents, grandparents, who are reaching these ripe old ages, did not have experience themselves of being the sandwich generation because their parents lived into their 40s or 50s or something. Or they didn't make it past their 30s because of whatever, maybe 30, maybe 50s. Because of the war, the Holocaust, etc. So this is a whole new phenomenon, and we have for other kinds of situations, we have a template, we have a way of operating. This is brand new, and we're in a way forging the road. We're sort of establishing how to do this, because it is, in essence, brand new, and the elderly don't have it. They don't know themselves. They never witnessed someone growing old. It's a similar kind. I have to be a child of a Holocaust survivor, but many children of Holocaust survivors never knew what it was like to have a grandparent. Because, or their parents, for example. Sometimes many of their parents didn't know what it was like to have an adolescent child because they spend their adolescence in a ghetto or in a concentration camp. So when the kids became teens, they didn't know how to handle it. So when we've lived through it, it's easier. We can go into automatic pilot. But here there's no template. And another very important point, which is the exquisite loneliness of widowhood. In the normal course of life events, taking aside any kind of catastrophe, any kind of unthinkable, horrific event, there is nothing more difficult and more traumatic than losing a spouse. And if you think about it, you know, it's your best friend for years and years. Someone has been part of your everyday life for so many years, which you've shared so much, you've raised families together, etc. The loss of a spouse engenders a loneliness that is, unless you've lived through it, from what I understand, Baruch Hashem, I haven't, is almost indescribable. I just recently in my capacity as director of bereavement for my lifeline, went to Cleveland, where there have been a notice I go to all these warm climates in the regular way. But there was a number of untimely deaths, and there was one situation. It was not, you know, not the typical thing, because we usually, when we get involved, it's a very young parent, but it was someone who was 60 who passed away, and I met with the widower and his seven children. And what came up again was how to help. He was there. How do we help our father, you know? And we're going to come over. We're going to do this. And I said, I said to him, you know what? It's wonderful you're going to come over. It's wonderful you bring the grandchildren over. He can't replace his spouse. And he confirmed that. What his loneliness now is something you can't replace. So there needs to be an awareness. I mean, certainly you have to do what you can. But the loss of the spouse, which again is part of the sandwich generation, is part of what may happen, likely to happen, as you tend to take care of parents, is extremely difficult situation, and it's a unique type of loneliness that we need to at least acknowledge and recognize. And sometimes it happens to be a fact in work and, you know, in the field of psychology, that sometimes acknowledging that you can't do anything about it is a comfort. Saying, look, I can't undo this for you. I realize it's very difficult. I know what it's like because I don't live it, but I realize and I can't make it up to you. I can make it up a little bit. I can ameliorate it a little bit, but I can't make it up to you. It's in a way much more comforting than saying, we'll come over, we'll visit, we'll do this, and then you'll get remarried. You know, like to simplify and trivialize the profundity of this loss. But there's another piece that's also related, which is second marriages. Older people that get married, let's say after being widowed, etc., and they're in a, I'm not talking about a second marriage with younger people, let's say, but in these kind of situations. And a situation that I have often seen is, again, a couple in their 70s, both widowed, decide to get married, very nice, very beautiful, companionship, togetherness, etc., and within a year of the marriage, one of them has a stroke. And now suddenly you have a new spouse who doesn't have the years and years together, doesn't have that kind of deep, abiding relationship, and maybe entered into this relationship, will take care of each other, will help each other. Next thing she knows, she's got someone who's an invalid now, and she has the burden of attending to someone who is so compromised, and they don't want it. They sometimes don't want it, or they'll do it out of obligation, which is sometimes worse than not doing it at all. So they have that awkwardness then sometimes in the relationship between the children and this new spouse who now suddenly is in this predicament that he or she hadn't bargained for.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead. I just don't want to get bogged down with it.
What about the issue of dealing with your in-laws?
Yes. dealing with you, when you're talking about in-laws are getting older and you have to attend to them.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question, and I didn't address it, maybe I should have. Off the top of my head, let me just scan a little bit. I think that, in my experience, when it's been a very long relationship, I mean, if the in-laws have been in-laws for 30, 40 years, and there's a basically decent relationship, good relationship, mm-hmm. I have not seen many difficulties with the, let's say the spouse, let's say as we see, the woman is usually the caretaker. So if the woman is taking care of her father-in-law or mother-in-law, I haven't seen that to be too difficult when there's a pretty good relationship and that it's been so many years that they're almost like parents. If there have been difficulties, etc., then that can make it more complicated. When I think about it, sometimes where the one who's taking less care of them is a little bit overprotective or maybe guilty. Let's say with the man, with this guy, that's usually the case, but he's not helping them, so he's overly critical about his wife's attendance to the in-laws. But for the most part, I have not seen that to be a difficult, especially when it's been a long-standing relationship and they're getting along. My experience, if you've had different experiences, let me know. But
no, I'm just saying it's another factor that's in there that they...
It could be, again, with old issues. Yeah, that could be. That could be, absolutely, absolutely. Or for that matter, let's say if the daughter-in-law is in a second marriage, and it's a new relationship, that could be more complicated. Here's another very important point that I have observed in some of my work with bereavement, and it's, I think, important, again, we get to some issues later, which is that the elderly have a certain stoicism, a certain perspective on life that we don't realize. This comes up as we sometimes have to address the issue of sharing bad news with older people or something, sharing tragic news. And I have observed that the older people have a certain stoicism. I think to some extent, and maybe because of the life experience, especially if they've lived through a Holocaust or the war, they have seen so much that they take it with a certain almost a strength, because I don't like the word strength, but they take it in stride more than we do. And the other thing that's important is that the older person has already lost a lot of people, has faced death much more than we have faced misfortune, much more than we have. I was in the position, I mean, Baruch Hashem, my parents are alive, and my father is going to be turning 90 in about a month. And a few years ago, I was in the unenviable position of having to tell him about another one of his friends who passed away. And he just kind of looked at me and said, you know, people are dying nowadays, they never died before. You know, it's almost like they're getting a little bit used to it. So sometimes you have to keep that in mind. So that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I don't think we have to be so afraid to share bad news with them. I know sometimes there's this hesitation. My own feeling, my own bias is that they take it, in a way, sometimes better than we do. But also sometimes the middle generation, the sandwich generation, gets frustrated. If they have to share something sad or tragic or whatever, that they don't feel that the older people are sympathetic enough. And we lose sight of the fact that they're looking at it from a different vantage point. They're looking at it from the vantage point themselves, facing death within the next few years, having experienced many, many more such misfortune or losses, that it doesn't necessarily have the same impact that it does for us in the middle generation. Also, sometimes we get the middle generation gets frustrated with the older person's rigidity or failure to progress. And a classic example is the internet. I mean, there's classic examples of how the elderly, the reaction to the internet. I mean, I can even tell you again, as I mentioned, I mean, my kids, one of the most amusing parts of their lives is discussing the internet with my father. You know, they love, I mean, he'll has a computer, he'll type a letter, and he'll quickly erase it because he doesn't want to use up the memory. You know, it's they're hysterical about it. Or once my daughter sent him pictures of her children, and she spoke to them, they live in Israel, and spoke to him and said, that, did you get the picture? He said, no, I couldn't get it down. She said, well, you have to use Link. He said, I don't have Link. And that was it, you know. And so my daughter called me up. I couldn't even hear that. She was laughing so hard about my father doesn't have Link. But it's again, sometimes, now that's funny, but sometimes we get frustrated. And I just had someone in my office the other day who was going nuts over his mother and her cell phone, how she doesn't know how to use it. And she kind of called him how it's broken, and it's, and she doesn't know how to retrieve phone numbers. And by the time she figures out how to answer it, she lost the call. And, you know, it was nutty. But it's that general, especially with the technology today, the frustration with the elderly and their rigidity or difficulty associated with it. It's interesting that what I've observed, even with my father, part of his problem with the computer is that he can't use something from his generation that he doesn't understand how it works. Like, he would ask my kids, and my kids would explain something, he said, well, why? And my kids would grow up with technology. What do you mean, why? It just does, you know? It's a different way of thinking. Now, here's a very important point, which also can be a source of frustration, which is the imbalance between siblings when caring for older adults. It's my observation, and I'm not sure of studies about this, but it's my observation that very often, one or maybe two siblings have a disproportionate, call it either burden or privilege, of attending to older adults. It's very rarely evenly distributed. First of all, I think in families, certain kids are just more in that role of caring for the older adults, and there's geographic considerations. If you happen to live in the same city and then the other siblings live elsewhere, it's just pragmatically more likely, or sometimes it could be that maybe one of you is retired and the other ones are still working, so you have more time. So there may be pragmatic reasons, but sometimes I think it's just that usually one sibling in particular falls in the role of the caretaker or provider for the older parents. So there is very consistently different imbalances between siblings in caring for older adults. Also, who makes the decisions? Something that I've seen a lot of, I've even actually had to almost mediate situations like this myself, is, let's say again, we'll make it simple. Let's say there are two children in the family and the two sons, and one is primarily involved in the care of the elderly parent, and then the other son comes to make a decision, should the parent be in a nursing home, not in a nursing home, so the other son wants to have an equal say in the question. And there's sometimes some frustration and anger. You know, where were you? You weren't part of it. I should have more of a say. So very often those are issues that'll come up in caring for the older people. Placement in nursing facilities, a very loaded issue, which, by the way, touches upon halachic matters. I mean, sometimes it may involve the rabbi, but when do you make that decision? When do you make the decision to transfer a parent into a health-related facility, into a nursing home, et cetera, instead of taking care of them for yourself? A painstaking decision. And then the financial expenditures. How much money do you spend? How much of your own money do you spend? Do you dip into the money that the parents have themselves? How much do you dip into that? Do you spend the money yourself and get it back as a greater proportion of the inheritance? And should this be written out? Which I would say yes, it should be clear. It's always better if things are written out and understood. So these are considerations and issues that come up. Some of the considerations for older children at home. There's a saying in almost every single language, And I never understood this when my kids were young, but now I understand it. The saying is little children, little problems, big children, big problems. No one wonder, well, how could that be? A big child, you can talk to them, they'll talk back to you, you know. They can drive, you know. You have this little kid, they cry, you don't know what's troubling them. Everywhere you go, you have to carry, you know, a carriage and diapers, and you know. It's so much easier to have big kids. But what happens is, and here's the key point, that you love them just as much, but you have a fraction of the leverage. In other words, you, no matter how old your kid is, your care and your concern and your love for them is the same. But when they're younger, you can send them to their room. When you're younger, you can tell them who they can play with. You can't tell a 24-year-old whom he or she can play with. You can't even tell them who they can date. So we love them, we care about them, and for the most part, we know better than they do what they need. On the other hand, we can't control them as much. So we can steer, question, or obliquely direct, but we can't dictate. And that's the key challenge to parenting older children, that we're still parents, we're still involved, but we don't have that kind of control. It becomes much more skillful. If you will get, first of all, you may have to withdraw. You might have to just let them learn from their own mistakes. We learn from the school of hard knocks, which is one of the hardest things to do, which you would not do with a young child as much. But you have to, if you are going to be involved, you have to be involved much more passively, if you will. So that's what I said is that paradigm shift. That now suddenly, the parent's supposed to parent you, you're taking care of more, and the kids, who you're supposed to parent, you're taking care of less. And that's the huge adjustment of this next sandwich generation. And then, again, here's an important point, and I alluded to this earlier. And this was true when taking care of adults, but it's true for children as well. There may be certain things, let's say, take from the child's perspective, maybe certain things about the home. Let's assume for the most part it's a loving, caring home. But there may be certain things that were annoying, that were troubling, that were upsetting. When you live with it all the time, you take it in stride. I mean, I don't know how many of you know New York, but I live in a place called the Five Towns. I'm like 15 minutes from JFK. I don't hear the airplanes. You live there, you don't hear. When you live with something, you don't hear. In fact, my rabbi always says that when Mashiach comes, we'll be the first ones in Israel, right by JFK. So we'll be right there. But you know, but now take it from the child's perspective. For 18 years they lived at home, and the annoying habits and annoying things where they got used to. It didn't bother them. Now they went to Israel for a year or two, they went to YU for another year or two. They've been out of the house for the most part for a good 4 years. Now they move back home. Now those things become unbearable. And it becomes very important to try to give them as much space as possible, because once you've been away from it, to go back to it is hard. I mean, I don't know if this is comparable, but they say that an animal that's born in captivity, if you let them loose, if you try to then put them back in captivity, they just die. They can't take it. That once you've had a taste of something, you've gotten away from something, to go back to it is extremely difficult. Again, as we alluded to earlier, financial issues, which is, again, you charge rent. Do they pay utilities? Do you expect them, if they're working, to participate in the provision for the home? Obviously, most don't. But these are questions. And privacy. You know, how much can you give them? They need their privacy at this age. And can you give it to them? And how much can you give it to them? I mean, one thing, if you have a basement, they live in the basement and come and go as they please. That's easy. What if you live in an apartment? What if you live in a smaller house? How do you give them their privacy and their space when they move back home like that? Okay, we'll take a break with a cartoon. It says, and you might not be able to see this well, it says, your mother and I are feeling overwhelmed, so you'll have to bring yourselves up. And that's the best solution. Okay. Now, so what are the approaches, okay? Okay, first of all, don't half give, whoever you intend to do so wholeheartedly. What do I mean? Okay? Your 24-year-old comes to you and says, you know, Mom, Dad, I just can't pay back these loans anymore. I really need help. Can you take over? Can you pay back parts of the loans? Either say yes or say no. Don't say, all right, so we won't retire. Okay, I'll do it. I don't know how we're going to do it, but somehow we'll do it. That's the worst thing to do. But don't say, I hate to say no. I'll say no, but I really feel terrible. You know, that's not, yeah, yes or no. That's always the best thing. Or for that matter, if you have that, as we alluded to earlier, that split between going to your kid's ball game or going to take your father to the doctor. However, whatever decision you make, and however you make the decision, maybe we'll get to that a little bit. Once you've made the decision, then you're doing that 100%. Don't go to the ball game on the cell phone talking to the doctor. That's the worst thing to do, okay? If you're at the ball game, be at the ball game. If you're at the doctor, be at the doctor. But whatever you do, you know, give 100%. Here I'm the whole idea of giving, because that's what you're doing, that's what this is all about, is who you're giving to. And as I said, the bigger challenge is to give to someone who you're not used to giving to. And there's a joy in giving. It's a basic chazal, also basic rabbis tell us that when you give, you have more. Aser b'shvil shatis aser, that you, when you give, you have more. It's a little bit like, I think, like breastfeeding. Like the more you breastfeed, the more you have. And it's true. When you give, if you give in that way, you find how much you have to give. And the test of true giving is out of love and for the other. In other words, real giving is not giving for yourself, but giving for the other person. And if you, to the extent that you can put yourself aside and give to the other person, when you're doing something for your child, when you're doing it not for your own selfish purposes, but you're doing it for that kid's best interest, or you're doing something for your parent, you're not doing it for yourself, but you're doing it for their best interest, that's the true giving, and that's the real challenge. There's a depression study on giving. This was an amazing study. Someone in the University of Massachusetts, which is somewhere out, you know, I'm a New Yorker, so it's not a stop in the subway. It must be around here somewhere. I don't know, Massachusetts. But anyway, what they did was, some of my best friends are from Massachusetts, right? so they did a study. Some lady came up with an idea that people who are depressed, if they would be lavished, if they'd be given a lot to, they might become less depressed. So she got volunteers each one was assigned to a person suffering from depression, and this person would take the person out and would buy them gifts and spend a lot of time with them. And she wanted to see if that would help their depression. And you know what she found? For the depressed people, it didn't make a bit of difference. But the ones who were giving felt a lot better about themselves. So the giving, the real true giving, this kind of giving, can be a joyous experience, can be a fulfilling experience. It takes some getting used to, it takes a mind shift, but once you get there, it can be a very fulfilling experience. Also, keep, and this is a very important point, especially as the economy gets worse, differentiate between spending and wasting. Spending money is why you're working. Wasting money is bad. I always tell my kids, I mind the extra $2 I have to spend because the light was left on overnight more than the $50,000 I'm spending on tuitions. Because supposedly I'm getting something for the tuitions. That's debatable. But let's say I am. I'm getting something for the tuition. I don't mind spending it. But the light on a whole night when nobody's using it is wasteful. And that's what we have to keep in mind ourselves when we spend so much money for the care of others. That if we spend it, that's what we wanted. The wasting is the problem. Be careful when you start resenting the recipient. That usually means that you're giving too much. And we'll talk about that later when you start resenting them. Involve others. You'll be surprised how much other people will help. If you are the sibling that's doing the bulk of the caring, you'll be surprised if you call the sibling you think wouldn't care less or wouldn't want to come and help you out. If you call them up and say, listen, I'm saturated. I can't take it anymore. Can you give me a week off? Can you come and spell me for a week? They'll do it. And there are volunteers, and there are agencies, and there are friends, and the people that, there's Bikur Cholim. There are people that will help. And if you are in that position where you have your kid's graduation and a very important meeting with let's say, a social worker about placement for an elderly parent, there are people that will help out. Maybe that's a bad example, but let's say just taking someone to a doctor. There are volunteers that will take the person to a doctor. And there's nothing wrong with asking. That doesn't make you less of a person if you're in that situation, if you call for help from others. Allow older children to make mistakes and learn on their own. This is the School of Hard Knocks. I have an example for Naomi and Russ. I'm going to skip it because we're a little tight in time. Give them their space. Acceptance of disappointment, children. That's why this is a very big issue with older children. And I hear this a lot in my office, which is they're at this point, we're growing our whole lives. And by the time the kid is 24, they're pretty much shaped. I mean, there's a lot has been done. There's always disappointments. Nobody ever is fully satisfied with how their kids turn out. And you have to, part of the challenge when you have older children is coming to terms with those disappointments. I mean, our rabbis tell us that Abraham died with no regrets. That tells, I mean, all the rest of us are dying with regrets, you know? It's a reality of life that there'll be disappointments to children. Accept inequities between siblings and your spouse, especially with your spouse in terms of caring for the older child. It's never even. It can't be. Don't keep books. Don't measure. Here's a very hard thing. Set limits for those who in the past have disciplined you. Besides having to care for elderly people, sometimes you have to be parental in terms of setting limits. You have to tell them what you can do and not do. And first of all, besides the fact that it possibly tramples on kibbutz of aim, and that again for the rabbi to talk about, but you may have to discipline your parents. One of the classics, the example I've seen the most, is telling your elderly parent to stop driving. Very hard. and they resist it. They don't have a sense of themselves that their driving is not what it used to be. I understand here in Canada, the elderly have to take driving tests again. We don't have that, at least in New York, which we really should. I think it's a very good idea. But it's something, it's a very hard thing to do, and how do you do that while preserving their dignity and respect? Extremely difficult. And now your customers. Some children can take your absences from plays or athletic events easier than others. So you have not just a universal rule. Some kid may be able to take it more in stride. Other kids may have a harder time with that. Know your limits. Take guilt-free breaks. Very important. There's so much in here. At all these points, preserve your health, well-being. Don't overgive. That's not doing anybody a favor. There are limits. Even halakhically, the limit how much you can give for charity. There's just so much you can give, and don't overdo it, because then you'll start resenting the person. You won't be able to give as generously as you want. I'm citing here, I'm using my YU background, my Torah Mada background, Shakespeare from Othello. If you remember Othello, Othello was a great warrior, nearly conquered the world, and then, of course, he married someone, and his wife did to him what no army could, and basically destroyed him. And in classic Shakespearean form, at the end of the play, he kills his wife, and he's about to put the knife in his chest, and before he does, he said, then you must speak of one that loved not wisely, but too well. Love wisely, but not too well. It's a very important point. Give what you can, give in portions that you can give. Don't overdo it. I alluded earlier to the nursing home decision. Very hard decision, but that's related. There comes a point sometimes when you can't take care of the elderly, and you're doing them a favor, and you're doing yourself and your family a favor when you have to make that transfer. Don't treat the elderly with dignity. Don't infantilize or dumb down. Extremely important, even if they are needy, and even if they can't hear, and even if they're more limited. Everybody needs to be treated with dignity and respect, and you can care for them and attend to them and still maintain their dignity. Sharing sad information, painful news, as I said, my own feeling is that they handle a lot better than we think, and I don't think we have to insulate them. The other problem is, if you are going to hide something from them, make sure you really can hide it, because if you're going to hide something, then they're going to find out later. Not only do they have the sad news, now they're not going to trust you. They're always going to be thinking about, what else are you not telling me? So think twice before you hide sad news from elderly people. Draw upon their life experience. Allow them to consolidate their personal history. Part of being at that age, part of facing the end of your life, is you're putting your life together. So there may be a lot of talk about their past life experiences for their sake to consolidate. But for us, it's also interesting, too. The wonderful opportunity to learn more about where you came from, about your great-grandparents, etc. And while you're caring for them, while you're driving them to the doctor, it's a wonderful opportunity for them and for you. It's as the Talmud says, Zenen and Zenen, you both benefit. Don't use responsibilities to avoid other situations such as marital or career issues. An important point, sometimes it's the flip side. Sometimes if you're having problems in your marriage or you're having problems in your career, the opportunity to take care of someone else is an escape. And don't use the need to take care of elderly, let's in this in particular, as an excuse to get away from your marriage or get away from having to make a decision about your work, etc. It catches up with you. A key point, look for meaning in your situation. We kind of alluded to that earlier. The research psychologically shows that whenever you're in a difficult situation, whether it's traumatic or any kind of misfortune, if you can find meaning, if you can attach meaning to it, then it becomes more tolerable. And it's a very personal thing. Whether it's, you know, whether the mitzvah you're fulfilling, whether it's your payback for everything they did for you, whether you're modeling for your children when you reach an old age, whatever it is, give it some positive. If it's becoming stressful, give it a positive meaning. Never let anyone feel like a burden. Let even frail and elderly have a role and function. A lot of people will say in literature of geropsychiatry, give them something to do. Let them know they have a function. The function can be the family history. The function can be asking them for advice about things or helping out a child in an area where they have skills. Let them feel useful, let them feel important. And the last point is, another point very important is the unique role of grandparent. A grandparent, you know, I certainly don't have to convince you that a father and a mother have a very important role in shaping us and who we are. But a grandparent has a very important role also. The grandparent represents unadulterated giving. I don't tell you, the grandparent gives and gives and gives and never has to discipline and never has to do any, you know, when the diaper gets full, they hand it back to the child. Actually, my mother says that in Europe, when she was a child, they used to call grandchildren, maybe you know Yiddish, they used to call grandchildren, Sinim from the Sinim, the enemies of the enemies. And the reason why grandparents and grandchildren get along so is that they have a mutual enemy. So that's what she used to call my kids, the Sinim from the Sinim. But it's a very special relationship. And if you're blessed to have it, let your children, even your older children, have it. And the last point is never underestimate what you can do. It happens to be human nature that while you're doing something, you don't realize how much you're doing. But when you look back, you realize what you've done. It's an incredible phenomenon. I mean, sometimes if you've ever been through a difficult period, I can say sometimes we at Lifeline, where we're counseling, Lo Elena, which you should know her, but parents who help a kid survive cancer. And when they look back what they did over those years, it's staggering to them. So don't think you can't. There's a lot you can do, and sometimes you don't even realize, to be honest, that maybe that's how God made us, that we don't realize we're doing so much while we're doing it. It really touches upon a very beautiful Gemara, the Gemara in Sukkah, Nun Beis Amud Beis, talks about in the end of times, Acharis HaYomim, God will destroy the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, and he'll show it to everybody. And he'll show it to the righteous people, and he'll show it to the bad people. The righteous people overcame it, their negative inclinations, and the evil people, let's say, who were succumbed to it. And he said, and it says, to the righteous people, it looked like a huge mountain. To the bad people, it looked like a little piece of thread. And it says, v'heim bochem, and they both cry. The people who succumbed to it cry and say, I let this little piece of thread get in my way. And the righteous people cry, shall weep and say, how are we able to overcome such a high mountain? Sometimes when you take on a task, if you surmount it, you won't believe you can climb mountains and not realize it. If you avoid it, you can let a piece of thread get in your way. And as a last cartoon before we take questions, it shows a young boy sitting there, father with baseball glove. He goes, quality time? Do I have to? Okay. I'm sorry I went a little longer than I thought, but maybe we have a few minutes. Just some rebuttals, give and takes, questions. Wow. Wake up.
Could have been a one-day course. Could have been a one-day course, all these points almost.
Yeah. I guess it was a lot, but I guess maybe I did a bit over. But yeah, go ahead.
Do you ever need to get a thank you for what you've done?
You may get a thank you, probably not. You may get it, certainly not from children, forget it, you know, like that. But a thank you should never demand or expect it. If you get it, it's wonderful. You know, the truth of the matter I often say is that by the time kids figure out how much their parents did for them, the parents have Alzheimer's anyway, and they don't understand, you know, you can't, you know, but it is perhaps a shortcoming on our part that we don't express gratitude enough. Maybe we should. Maybe we should take our time from time to time and express gratitude for everything that everybody does, but don't count it. For sure not. Yeah.
Could you elaborate on the point, don't use responsibility to avoid other situations?
Yeah.
One
rabbi in my community told me, I hope I'm not, well, maybe I should be careful saying this. Okay, let's just put it this way. Sometimes people will volunteer their time for causes or for others because they really feel a tremendous need and they feel, you know, for the cause. And sometimes people will do it to get away from the home or to get away from other concerns or other problems. So they immerse themselves in something as an escape. In other words, it's they're more running away from something than running towards something. And that's the problem, because first of all, you're not doing it, as we say in French, le schmuck, you're not doing it out of pure altruism, which never works well. And the problems don't go away. They just escalate. So that's what I mean. So you have to be careful that there are situations where, let's say, someone will bury themselves in the care for an elderly parent, not just because, or maybe, let's say, not so much because of the parent, but they want to get away from the husband or something like that. That's not
how does one recognize it? How does one reverse it?
Usually, it's a good point. How do you recognize it? First of all, it has a little bit more, I'll use a technical term, a little bit more of a compulsive nature when you're escaping somewhere. You have to. Not because you want to, because you need to do it to get away from something else. And it's also not, you know, once you get there and get involved in the cause, you're not doing it really with a whole heart. But that's not your main motive. So then sometimes you get more frustrated with the person you're helping or some, you know, another example typically is when you come, let's say somebody in that situation comes to visit the elderly parent, everything's fine. And they're looking for problems, they're looking for different things, you know, because they want to be there rather than home with the kids or something like that. That's what how you'd recognize. But it comes out, the worst of us. Because the problem doesn't go away. It follows you. A little bit like an albatross.
You never ever written it. How do you reverse it?
You deal with the real problem, the real issue. You go back and deal with the real issue. That's the point. Go back, you know, if you're running away from your kids, deal with the kids. If you're running away from having to decide whether to go back to work, face that issue. Maybe decide not to go back to work, but don't make yourself busy with a parent because you don't want to go back to work. That's not the way you do it. Yes?
Could you
find that older grandchildren and the elderly care aging parents.
Older grandchildren, yes, that's a wonderful thing to do. Not too much. You shouldn't overdo it. Because they have their own lives and it's more your responsibility. But to give them, chores, to give them, or let them spell you, or if you can take a long weekend, give you the break, and let them, you know, move in so they can attend to the parents. A wonderful thing to do. So in pieces, in bite-sized pieces, absolutely. It's great. Yeah. Somebody else said something? Yeah.
There's always a challenge between an elderly parent who doesn't want to tell you things that are going wrong. They're their demand for their privacy, and your desire to know what's actually happening because the decision-making that they're making, you may not even feel that it's being skewed. So how do you...
Yeah, I think that's a little bit like what I mentioned earlier in terms of, like, the driving. There comes a point where you have to say, I'm sorry. You have to take off. You become it's a very hard thing.
Driving is one thing. There's like medical issues that they may not tell you about.
Right. But if you don't need to know, you know, as they say in Latin, lasina soi, leave it alone. You know, let them find. If they can attend, they're still in a position where they understand, they can go to the position, they can attend to it, and they want to keep it private. They're still functioning adults, and that's their privilege. But if it's a situation where you need to be involved because they're not processing as clearly as you are, and they're not necessarily going to the best position because they can't travel, and you need to get involved, then you have to take over, and you have to be the one who disciplines them. Very hard, and to try to do it in a respectful fashion. And it's extremely difficult, but you may come to that point. That's, again, psychologically, that's that paradigm shift, which is very difficult. Yeah?
Teenagers especially are very self-centered creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I find that often they resent the time that you have to give to a parent. And while in part we're showing them how to take care of a parent, so in fact they'll take care of you when they reach that stage, and mm-hmm. modeling that, how do you deal with that?
Gotcha. I actually have a friend who has 11 children. He once told me he had 11 children, figured the odds are that at least one of them will take care of himself, you know? I think in that respect, I'm not sure it makes a very big difference about teenagers. In fact, more so I think even younger children, because teenagers have a slightly better understanding. First of all, if a child does complain, one of the things you have to do is think it out yourself whether maybe they're right. And maybe you are spending too much time with the parent and too little time with them. It may be legitimate. That might not be just self-centeredness. But let's say you thought it out and you really are being, you know, you're giving to both of them as much as you can. Then, first of all, it might be an unrelated issue. First of all, it might be with a teenager, which would be more likely. It might be just because they want to bust your pegs. You know, they you know, that's teenagers. They just want to find something wrong with you, because that's part of the age itself. So then you take it in stride. You know, that might be more typical. But it might be, also what kids will often do is sometimes express displeasure with something that's easier to express displeasure with. So if the teen is unhappy because of some other matter, let's say, it might even be personal, nothing to do with you. It's easier for them to complain to you about the time you spend in that than to come to you and say, you know, I'm upset because of things that are happening to me, or upset about, you know, or et cetera. So you have to also consider whether they aren't displacing something else on that matter. If it's really straight, you know, you've assessed it, you're really being very even-handed. They're just being self-centered more than you think is necessary, then it's discipline again. It's tough nuggets, you know, yeah. But you have to feel then, once you've made that assessment, you have to feel guilt-free when you say it. And the children have radar. They read you very well. And if you say it to them in a way with guilt, where you're hesitant yourself, they'll pick up on it. If you're clear yourself that you're portioning out your time evenly in the right way, and you impart that to them, and it's not a displacement of other issues, or it's not just teenagers being bratty, they'll accept it. They'll know it. Absolutely. Okay, good. All right. Thank you very much. I'm around if there's any other questions.
Just a quick word. First of all, thank you very much, Dr. Blumenthal. Thank you to each of you for coming. The next two sessions, the session in here will be Phyllis Crew, and she will be speaking about creating happy kids or ways to make happy kids. I forget what the exact wording on that is. You can help me there? I'm sorry? You're in the back. How to make happy kids. And in the next room over, we will be having Sarah Hannah Ratcliffe, who will be speaking about 10 ways not to discipline your kids. So that will be starting at 10:45. There's also just one important critical point. there are so many bagels left over that I am not thrilled about, because, you know, in these economic times, we like food to be eaten. So, but please enjoy. That session is actually still in session, so we'll be wrapping up in about 3 to 5 minutes. And we hope you enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you all.